At Verizon, anyone can trade in their old phone for a new one on us with Unlimited Ultimate, which means everyone in your family could get a new phone and stay on your family plan, keeping you close.
Hey, Mom, you seen my toothbrush?
Yeah, I'm almost done with it.
Oh, maybe too close. Trade-in and additional terms apply. See Verizon.com for details.
New year, same great savings. All in the Kroger app.
Get Kroger Spiral Sliced Ham for 89 cents a pound with your card and an additional $25 purchase limit too. Then get large avocados or mangoes for 99 cents each with your card and a digital coupon.
Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Book 5, chapters 6 to 9 of 10 books on architecture. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Fredrik Karlsson. 10 books on architecture by Vitruvius. Translated by Morris Hickey Morgan. Chapter 6. Plan of the Theatre. 1. The plan of the theatre itself is to be constructed as follows. Having fixed upon the principal centre, draw a line or circumference equivalent to what is to be the perimeter at the bottom, and in it inscribe four equilateral triangles at equal distances apart and touching the boundary line of the circle, as the astrologers do in the figure of the 12 signs of the zodiac when they are making computations from the musical harmony of the stars. Taking that one of these triangles whose side is nearest to the scaena, let the front of the scaena be determined by the line where the side cuts off a segment of the circle, and draw, through the center, a parallel line set off from that position, to separate the platform of the stage from the space of the orchestra. 2. The platform has to be made deeper than that of the Greeks, because all our artists perform on the stage, while the orchestra contains the places reserved for the seats of senators. The height of this platform must not be more than 5 feet, in order that those who sit in the orchestra may be able to see the performances of all the actors. The sections, cunei, for spectators in the theatre, should be so divided that the angles of the triangles, which run about the circumference of the circle, may give the direction for the flights of steps between the sections as far as up to the first curved cross aisle. Above this, the upper sections are to be laid out, midway between the lower sections, with alternating passageways. 3. The angles at the bottom, which give the directions for the flights of steps, will be 7 in number. The other 5 angles will determine the arrangement of the scene. Thus, the angle in the middle ought to have the royal door opposite to it. The angles to the right and left will designate the position of the doors for guest chambers, and the 2 outermost angles will point to the passages in the wings. The steps for the spectators' places, where the seats are arranged, should be not less than 1 foot and 1 palm in height, nor more than 1 foot and 6 fingers. Their depth should be fixed at not more than 2.5 feet, nor less than 2 feet. 4. The roof of the colonnade to be built at the top of the rows of the seats should lie level with the top of the scaena, for the reasons that the voice will then rise with equal power until it reaches the highest rows of seats and the roof. If the roof is not so high in proportion as it is lower, it will check the voice at the point which the sound first reaches. 5. Take 1/6 of the diameter of the orchestra between the lower steps, and let the lower seats at the ends on both sides be cut away to a height of that dimension so as to leave entrances. At the point where this cutting away occurs, fix the soffits of the passages. Thus their vaulting will be sufficiently high. 6. The length of the scaena ought to be double the diameter of the orchestra. The height of the podium, starting from the level of the stage, is, including the corona and cymatium, 1/12 of the diameter of the orchestra. Above the podium, the columns, including their capitals and bases, should have a height of 1/4 of the same diameter, and the architraves and ornaments of the columns should be 1/5 of their height. The parapet above, including its cyma and corona, is 1/2 the height of the parapet below. Let the columns above this parapet be 1/4 less in height than the columns below, and the architraves and ornaments of these columns 1/5 of their height. If the scaena is to have 3 stories, Let the uppermost parapet be half the height of the intermediate one, the columns at the top one fourth less high than the intermediate, and the architraves and coronae of these columns one-fifth of their height as before. 7. It is not possible, however, that in all theatres these rules of symmetry should answer all conditions and purposes, but the architect ought to consider to what extent he must follow the principles of symmetry, and to what extent it may be modified to suit the nature of the site or the size of the work. There are, of course, some things which, for utility's sake, must be made of the same size in a small theatre and a large one, such as the steps, curved cross aisles, their parapets, the passages, stairways, stages, tribunals, and any other things which occur that make it necessary to give up symmetry so as not to interfere with utility. Again, if in the course of the work any of the material falls short, such as marble, timber, or anything else that is provided, it will not be amiss to make it a slight reduction or addition, provided that it is done without going too far, but with intelligence. This will be possible if the architect is a man of practical experience and besides not destitute of cleverness and skill. 8. The scene itself displays the following scheme. In the center are double doors decorated like those of a royal palace. At the right and left are the doors of the guest chambers. Beyond are spaces provided for decoration, places that the Greeks called periaktoi, because in these places are triangular pieces of machinery which revolve, each having three decorated faces. When the play is to be changed, or when guards enter to the accompaniment of sudden claps of thunder, these may be revolved and present a face differently decorated. Beyond these places are the projecting wings which afford entrances to the stage, one from the forum, the other from abroad. 9. There are three kinds of scenes, one called the tragic, second the comic, third the satiric. Their decorations are different and unlike each other in scheme. Tragic scenes are delineated with columns, pediments, statues, and other objects suited to kings. Comic scenes exhibit private dwellings, with balconies and views representing rows of windows after the manner of ordinary dwellings. Satiric scenes are decorated with trees, caverns, mountains, and other rustic objects delineated in landscape style. Chapter 7. Greek Theatres. 1. In the theatres of the Greeks, these same rules of construction are not to be followed in all respects. First, in the circle at the bottom where the Roman has four triangles, the Greek has three squares with their angles touching the line of circumference. The square whose side is nearest to the scaena and cuts off a segment of the circle determines by this line the limits of the proscenium. Parallel to this line and tangent to the outer circumference of the segment, a line is drawn which fixes the front of the scaena. Through the center of the orchestra and parallel to the direction of the proscenium, a line is laid off, and centers are marked where it cuts the circumference to the right and left, at the ends of the half-circle. Then, with the compasses fixed at the right, an arc is described from the horizontal distance at the left to the left-hand side of the proscenium. Again, with the center at the left end, an arc is described from the horizontal distance at the right to the right hand of the proscenium. 2. As a result of this plan, with three centers, the Greeks have a roomier orchestra and a scaena set further back, as well as a stage of less depth. They call this the logeion for the reason that there the tragic and comic actors perform on the stage, while other artists give their performance in the entire orchestra. Hence, from this fact, they are given in Greek the distinct name scenic and tumelic. The height of this logeion ought not to be less than 10 feet nor more than 12. Let the ascending flights of steps between the wedges of seat, as far up as the first curved cross aisle, be laid out on lines directly opposite to the angles of the squares. Above the cross aisle, let other flights be laid out in the middle between the first and at the top. As often there is a new cross aisle, the number of flights of steps is always increased to the same extent. Chapter 8. Acoustics of the site of a theatre. 1. All this having been settled with greatest pains and skills, we must see to it, with still greater care, that a site have been selected where the voice has a gentle fall, and is not driven back with a recoil so as to convey an indistinct meaning to the ear. There are some places which from their very nature interfere with the course of the voice, as for instance the dissonant, which are termed in Greek katechontes, the circumsonant, which with them are named periechontes, again the resonant, which are termed antechontes, and the consonant, which they call synechontes. The dissonant are those places in which the first sound uttered that is carried up high strikes against solid bodies above, and being driven back, checks as it sinks to the bottom the rise of the succeeding sound. 2. The circumsonant are those in which the voice spreads all round, and then is forced into the middle, where it dissolves, the case endings are not heard, and it dies away there in sounds of indistinct meaning. The resonant are those in which it comes into contact with some solid substance and recoils, thus producing an echo, and making the terminations of cases sound double. The consonant are those in which it is supported from below, increases as it goes up, and reaches the ears in words which are distinct and clear in tone. Hence, if there has been careful attention in the selection of the site, the effect of the voice will, through this precaution, be perfectly suited to the purposes of a theatre. The drawings of the plans may be distinguished from each other by this difference. The theatres designed by squares are meant to be used for Greeks, while Roman theatres are designed from equilateral triangles. Whoever is willing to follow these directions will be able to construct perfectly correct theatres. Chapter 9. Colonnades and Walks. 1. Colonnades must be constructed behind the scena, so that when sudden showers interrupt plays, the people may have somewhere to retire from the theatre, and so that there may be room for the preparation of all the outfit of the stage. Such places, for instance, are the colonnades on Pompeii, and also in Athens, the colonnades of Eumenes, and the fane of Father Bacchus, also, as you leave the theatre, the music hall, which Themistocles surrounded with stone columns and roofed with the yards and masts of ships captured from the Persians. It was burned during the war with Mithridates and afterwards restored by King Ariobarzanes. At Smyrna there is the Stratonicium, at Tralles a colonnade on each side of the Sina, above the race course, and in other cities which have had careful architects there are colonnades and walks about the theatres. 2. The approved way of building them requires that they should be double, and have Doric columns on the outside, with the architraves and their ornaments finished according to the law of modular proportion. The approved depth of them requires that the depth from the lower part of the outermost columns to the columns in the middle, and from the middle columns to the wall, enclosing the walk under the colonnade, should be equal to the height of the outer column. Let the middle columns be one-fifth higher than the outer columns, and designed in the Ionic or Corinthian style. 3. The columns will not be subject to the same rules of symmetry and proportion which I prescribed in the case of sanctuaries, for the dignity which ought to be their quality in temples of the gods is one thing, but their elegance in colonnades and other public works is quite another. Hence, if the columns are to be of the Doric order, let their height, including the capital, be measured off in 15 parts. Of these parts, let one be fixed upon the form, the module, and in accordance with this module the whole work is to be developed. Let the thickness of the columns at the bottom be 2 modules, and intercolumniation 5.5 modules, the height of a column, excluding the capital, 14 modules, the capital 1 module in height, and 2 1/6 modules in breadth. Let the modular proportions of the rest of the work be carried out as written in the 4th book in the case of temples. 4. But if the columns are to be Ionic, let the shaft, excluding base and capital, be divided into 8.5 parts, and let one of these be assigned to the thickness of a column. Let the base, including the plinth, be fixed at 1/2 the thickness, and let the proportions of the capital be as shown in the 3rd book. If the column is to be Corinthian, let its shaft and base be proportioned as in the Ionic, but its capital as has been written in the 4th book. In the stylobates, let the increase made there by means of the scamilla impares be taken from the description written above in the 3rd book. Let the architraves, coronae, and all the rest be developed in proportion to the columns from what has been written in the foregoing books. 5. The space in the middle, between the colonnades and open to the sky, ought to be embellished with green things. for walking in the open air is very healthy, particularly for the eyes, since the refined and rarefied air that comes from green things, finding its way in because of the physical exercise, gives a clean-cut image, and by clearing away the gross humours from the eyes, leaves the sight keen and the image distinct. Besides, as the body gets warm with exercise and walking, this air, by sucking out the humours from the frame, diminishes their superabundance and disperses, and thus reduces the superfluity which is more than the body can bear. 6. That this is so may be seen from the fact that misty vapours never arise from springs of water which are under cover, nor even from watery marshes which are underground, but in uncovered places which are open to the sky, when the rising sun begins to act upon the world with its heat, it brings out the vapour from damp and watery spots, and rolls it in masses upwards. Therefore, if it appears that in places open to the sky, the more noxious humours are sucked out of the body by the air, as they obviously are from the earth in the form of mists, I think there is no doubt that cities should be provided with the roomiest and most ornamented walks, laid out under the free and open sky. 7. That they may be always dry and not muddy, the following is to be done. Let them be dug down and cleared out to the lowest possible depth. At the right and left construct covered drains, and in their walls, which are directed towards the walks, lay earthen pipes with their lower ends inclined into the drains. Having finished these, fill up the place with charcoal, and then strew sand over the walks and level them off. Hence, on account of the porous nature of the charcoal and the insertion of the pipes into the drains, quantities of water will be conducted away, and the walks will thus be rendered perfectly dry and without moisture. 8. Furthermore, our ancestors in establishing these works provided cities with storehouses for an indispensable material. The fact is that in sieges everything else is easier to procure than is wood. Salt can easily be brought in beforehand, corn can be got together quickly by the state or by individual, and if it gives out, the defence may be maintained on cabbage, meat, or beans. Water can be had by digging wells, and when there are sudden falls of rain, by collecting it from the tiles. For a stock of wood, which is absolutely necessary for cooking food, is a difficult and troublesome thing to provide, for it is slow to gather and a good deal is consumed. 9. On such occasions, therefore, these walks are thrown open, and a definite allowance granted to each inhabitant according to tribes. Thus these uncovered walks ensure two excellent things. First, health in time of peace. Secondly, safety in time of war. Hence, walks that are developed on these principles and built not only behind the Sina or theatres, but also at the temples of all the gods, will be capable of being of great use to cities. As it appears that we have given an adequate account of them, next will follow descriptions of the arrangements of baths. End of Book 5, Chapter 9. Book 5, Chapters 10 to 12 of 10 Books on Architecture. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Fredrik Karlsson. 10 Books on Architecture by Vitruvius. Translated by Morris Hickey Morgan. Chapter 10. Baths. 1. In the first place, the warmest possible situation must be selected, that is, one which faces away from the north and northeast. The rooms for the hot and tepid bath should be lighted from the southwest, or, if the nature of the situation prevents this, at all events from the south, because the set time for bathing is principally from midday to evening. We must also see to it that the hot bathrooms in the women's and men's departments adjoin each other, and are situated in the same quarter, for thus it will be possible that the same furnace should serve both of them and their fittings. 3 bronze cauldrons are to be set over the furnace, one for hot, another for tepid, and the third for cold water, placed in such positions that the amount of water which flows out of the hot water cauldron may be replaced from that for tepid water, and in the same way the cauldron for tepid water may be supplied from that for cold. The arrangement must allow the semi-cylinders for the bath basins to be heated from the same furnace. 2. The hanging floors of the hot bathrooms are to be constructed as follows. First, the surface of the ground should be laid with tiles 1.5 feet square, sloping towards the furnace in such a way that, if a ball is thrown in, it cannot stop inside, but must return of itself to the furnace room. Thus the heat of the fire will more readily spread under the hanging flooring. Upon them, pillars made of 8-inch bricks are built and set at such a distance apart that 2-foot tiles may be used to cover them. These pillars should be 2 feet in height, laid with clay mixed with hair, and covered on top with the 2-foot tiles which support the floor. 3. The vaulted ceilings will be more serviceable if built of masonry, but if they are of framework, they should have tile work on the underside, to be constructed as follows. Let iron bars or arcs be made, and hang them to the framework by means of iron hooks set as close together as possible, and let these bars or arcs be placed at such distances apart that each pair of them may support and carry an unflanged tile. Thus the entire vaulting will be completely supported on iron. These vaults should have the points on their upper side dawed with clay mixed with hair, and their underside, facing the floor, should first be plastered with pounded tile mixed with lime, and then covered with polished stucco in relief or smooth. Vaults in hot bathrooms will be more serviceable if they are doubled, for then the moisture from the heat will not be able to spoil the timber in the framework, but will merely circulate between the two vaults. 4. The size of the baths must depend upon the number of the population. The rooms shall thus be proportioned. Let their breadth be 1/3 of their length, excluding the niches for the washbowl and the bath basin. The washbowl ought without fail to be placed under a window so that the shadows of those who stand round it may not obstruct the light. Niches for washbowls must be made so roomy that when the first comers have taken their places, the others who are waiting round may have proper standing room. The bath basin should be not less than 6 feet broad from the wall to the edge, the lower step and the cushion taking up 2 feet of this space. 5. The laconium and the other sweating baths must adjoin the tepid room, and their height to the bottom of the curved dome should be equal to their width. Let an aperture be left in the middle of the dome with a bronze discharging from it by chains. By raising and lowering it, the temperature of the sweating baths can be regulated. The chamber itself ought, as it seems, to be circular, so that the force of the fire and heat may spread evenly from the center all round the circumference. Chapter 11. The Palaestra. 1. Next, although the building of palaestrae is not usual in Italy, I think it best to set forth the traditional way and to show how they are constructed among the Greeks. The square or oblong peristyle in the palaestra should be so formed that the circuit of it makes a walk of 2 stadia, a distance which the Greek called diaulos. Let 3 of its colonnades be single, but let the 4th, which is on the south side, be doubled, so that when there is bad weather accompanied by wind, the drops of rain may not be able to reach the interior. 2. In the 3 colonnades construct roomy recesses with seats in them, where philosophers, rhetoricians, and others who delight in learning may sit and converse. In the double colonnade let the rooms be arranged thus. The young men's hall in the middle, this is a very spacious recess, exedra, with seats in them, and it should be 1/3 longer than it is broad. At the right, the bag room, then next the dust room, beyond the dust room, at the corner of the colonnade, the cold washing room, which the Greeks called lotron. At the left of the young man's hall is the anointing room, then, next to the anointing room, the cold bath room, and beyond that a passage into the furnace room, at the corner of the colonnade. Next, but inside, and on a line with the cold bathroom, put the vaulted sweating bath, its length twice its breadth, and having at ends on one side a laconium, proportioned in the same manner as above described, and opposite the laconium the warm washing room. Inside the palaestra the peristyle ought to be laid out as described above. 3. But on the outside let 3 colonnades be arranged, one as you leave the peristyle, and 2 at the right and left, with running tracks in them. That one of them which faces the north should be a double colonnade of very ample breadth, while the other should be single, and so constructed that on the sides next the walls and the side along the columns it may have edges, serving as paths, of not less than 10 feet, with the spaces between them sunken, so that steps are necessary in going down from the edges 1.5 feet to the plain, which plain should be not less than 12 feet wide. Thus people walking round the edges will not be interfered with by the anointed who are exercising. 4. This kind of colonnade is called among the Greeks systos, because athletes during the winter season exercise in covered running tracks. Next to this systos, and to the double colonnade, should be laid out the uncovered walks, which the Greeks term paradromides, and our people systa, into which, in fair weather during the winter, the athletes come out from the systos for exercise. The cista ought to be so constructed that there may be plantations between the two colonnades, or groves of plane trees, with walks laid out in them among the trees, and resting places there made of opus signinum. Behind the cistas, a stadium so designed that great numbers of people may have plenty of room to look on at the contest between the athletes. I have now described all that seemed necessary for the proper arrangement of things within the city walls. Chapter 12. Harbors, breakwaters, and shipyards. 1. The subject of the usefulness of harbors is one which I must not omit, but must explain by what means ships are sheltered in them from storms. If their situation has natural advantages, with projecting capes or promontories, which curve or return inwards by their natural conformation, such harbors are obviously of the greatest service. Round them, of course, colonnades or shipyards must be built, or passages from the colonnades to the business quarters, and towers must be set up on both sides, from which chain can be drawn across by machinery. 2. But if we have situation without natural advantages, and unfit to shelter ships from storms, it is obvious that we must proceed as follows. If there is no river in the neighbourhood, but if there can be a roadstead on one side, then let the advances be made from the other side by means of walls or embankments, and let the enclosing harbour be thus formed. Walls which are to be under water should be constructed as follows. Take the powder which comes from the country, extending from Cumae to the promontory of Minerva, and mix it in the mortar trough in the proportion of 2:1. 3. Then, the lower surface inside, under the water, must be leveled off and dredged, working from beams laid across, and finally, concrete from the mortar trough, the stuff having been mixed as described above, must be heaped up until the empty space which was within the cofferdam is filled up by the wall. This, however, is possessed as a gift of nature by such places as have been described above. But if by recent occurrence, or the assaults of the open sea, the props cannot hold the cofferdam together, then let the platform of the greatest possible strength be constructed, beginning on the ground itself or on a substructure, and let the platform be constructed with a level surface for less than half its extent, while the rest, which is close to the beach, slopes down and out. 4. Then, on the water's edge and at the sides of the platform, let marginal walls be constructed, about 1.5 feet thick, and brought up to a level with the surface above mentioned. Next, let the sloping part be filled in with sand and leveled off with the marginal wall and the surface of the platform. Then, upon this level surface, construct a block as large as is required, and when it is finished, leave it not for not less than 2 months to dry. Then cut away the marginal wall which supports the sand. Thus the sand will be determined by the waves, and this will cause the block to fall into the sea. By this method, repeated as often as necessary, an advance into the water can be made. 5. But in places where this powder is not found, the following method must be employed. A cofferdam with double sides, composed of charred stakes fastened together with ties, should be constructed in the appointed place, and clay in wicker baskets made of swamp rushes should be packed in among the props. After this has been well packed down and filled in as closely as possible, set up your water screws, wheels, and drums, and let the space now bounded by the enclosure be emptied and dried. Then, dig out the bottom within the enclosure. If it proves to be of earth, it must be cleared out and dried till you come to solid bottom and for a space wider than the wall which is to be built upon it, and then filled in with masonry consisting of rubble, lime, and sand. 6. But if the place proves to be soft, the bottom must be staked with piles made of charred alder or olive wood, and then filled in with charcoals as has been prescribed in the case of the foundations of theatres and the city wall. Finally, build the wall of dimension stone with the bond stones as long as possible, so that particularly the stones in the middle may be held together by the joints. Then fill the inside of the walls with broken stone or masonry. It will thus be possible for even a tower to be built upon it. 7. When all this is finished, the general rule for shipyards will be to build them facing the north. Southern exposures from their heat produce rot, the woodworms, shipworms, and all sorts of other destructive creatures, and strengthen and keep them alive. And these buildings must by no means be constructed of wood for fear of fire. As for their size, no definite limit need to be set, but they must be built to suit the largest type of ship, so that if even larger ships are hauled up, they may find plenty of room there. I have described in this book the construction and completion of all that I could remember as necessary for general use in the public places of cities. In the following book I shall consider private houses, their conveniences and symmetrical proportions. End of Book 5. Book 6, Introduction and Chapter 1 of 10 Books on Architecture. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Fredrik Karlsson. 10 Books on Architecture by Vitruvius. Translated by Morris Hickey Morgan. Book 6, Introduction. 1. It is related of the Socratic philosopher Aristippus that, being shipwrecked and cast ashore on the coast of the Rhodians, he observed geometrical figures drawn thereon, and cried out to his companions, "Let us be of good cheer, for I see the traces of man." With that he made for the city of Rhodes, and went straight to the gymnasium. There he fell to discussing philosophical subjects, and presents were bestowed upon him so that he could not only fit himself out, but could also provide those who accompanied him with clothing and all other necessaries of life. When his companions wished to return to their country, and asked him what message he wished them to carry home, he bade them to say this, that children ought to be provided with property and resources of a kind that could swim with them, even out of a shipwreck. 2. These are indeed the true supports of life, and neither fortune's adverse gale, nor political revolution, nor ravages of war can do them any harm. Developing the same idea, Theophrastus, urging men to acquire learning rather than put their trust in money, states the case thus. The man of learning is the only person in the world who is neither a stranger when in a foreign land, nor friendless when he has lost his intimates and relatives. On the contrary, he is a citizen of every country, and can fearlessly look down upon the troublesome accidents of fortune. But he who thinks himself entrenched in defences not of learning but of luck, moves in slippery paths, struggling through life unsteadily and insecurely. 3. And Epicurus, in much the same way, says that the wise owe little to fortune, all that is greatest and essential is under the direction of the thinking power of the mind and the understanding. Many other philosophers have said the same thing. Likewise, the poets who wrote the ancient comedies in Greece have expressed the same sentiments in their verses on the stage. For example, Eucrates, Chionides, Aristophanes, and with them Alexis in particular, who says that the Athenians ought to be praised for the reason that, while the laws of all Greeks require the maintenance of parents by their children, the laws of the Athenians require this only in the case of those who have educated their children in the arts. All the gifts which fortune bestows she can easily take away, but education, when combined with intelligence, never fails, but abides steadily on to the very end of life. 4. Hence I am very much obliged and infinitely grateful to my parents for their approval of this Athenian law, and for having taken care that I should be taught an art, and that of a sort which cannot be brought to perfection without learning and a liberal education in all branches of instruction. Thanks, therefore, to the attention of my parents and the instruction given by my teachers, I obtained a wide range of knowledge, and by the pleasure which I take in literary and artistic subjects and in the writings of treatises, I have acquired intellectual possessions whose chief fruits are these thoughts, that superfluity is useless, and that not to feel the want of anything is true riches. There may be some people, however, who deem all this of no consequence, and think that the wise are those who have plenty of money. Hence, it is that very many, in pursuit of that end, take upon themselves impudent assurance, attain notoriety and wealth at the same time. 5. But for my part, Caesar, I have never been eager to make money by my art, but have gone on the principle that slender means and a good reputation are preferable to wealth and disrepute. For this reason, only a little celebrity has followed. But still, my hope is that, with the publication of these books, I shall become known even to posterity, and it is not to be wondered at that I am so generally unknown. Other architects go about and ask for opportunities to practice their profession, but I have been taught by my instructors that it is the proper thing to undertake a charge only after being asked, and not to ask for it, since a gentleman will blush with shame at petitioning for a thing that arouses suspicion. It is, in fact, those who can grant favours that are courted, not those who receive them. What are we to think must be the suspicions of a man who is asked to allow his private means to be expended in order to please a petitioner? Must he not believe that the thing is to be done for the profit and advantage of that individual? 6. Hence it was that the ancient used to entrust their work in the first place to architects of good family, and next inquired whether they had been properly educated, believing that one ought to trust in the honour of a gentleman rather than in the assurance of impudence. And the architects themselves would teach none but their own sons or kinsmen, and train them to be good men, who could be trusted without hesitation in matters of such importance. But when I see that this grand art is boldly professed by the uneducated and the unskilful, and by men who, far from being acquainted with architecture, have no knowledge even of the carpenter's trade, I can find nothing but praise for those householders who, in the confidence of learning, are emboldened to build for themselves. Their judgment is that, if they must trust to inexperienced persons, it is more becoming to them to use up a good round sum at their own pleasure than at that of a stranger. 7. Nobody, therefore, attempts to practice any other art in his own home, as, for instance, the shoemakers or the fullers or any other of the easier kinds, but only architecture, and this is because the professionals do not possess the genuine art, but term themselves architects falsely. For these reasons I have thought proper to compose most carefully a complete treatise on architecture and its principles, believing that it will be no unacceptable gift to all the world. In the fifth book I have said what I had to say about the convenient arrangement of public works. In this I shall set forth the theoretical principles and the symmetrical proportions of private houses. Chapter 1. On Climate as Determining the Style of the House. 1. If our designs for private houses are to be correct, we must at the outset take note of the countries and climates in which they are built. One style of house seems appropriate to build in Egypt, another in Spain, a different kind in Pontus, one still different in Rome, and so on with lands and countries of other characteristics. This is because one part of the earth is directly under the sun's course, another is far away from it, while another lies midway between these two. Hence, as the position of the heaven with regard to a given tract on the earth leads naturally to different characteristics, owing to the inclination of the circle of the zodiac and the course of the sun, it is obvious that designs for houses ought similarly to conform to the nature of the country and to diversities of climate. 2. In the north, houses should be entirely roofed over and sheltered as much as possible, not in the open, though having a warm exposure. But on the other hand, where the force of the sun is great in the southern countries that suffer from heat, houses must be built more in the open and with a northern or northeastern exposure. Thus we may amend by art what nature, if left but to herself, would mar. In other situations also we must make modifications to correspond to the position of the heaven and its effect on climate. 3. These effects are noticeable and discernible not only in things in nature, but they also are observable in the limbs and bodies of entire races. In places on which the sun throws out its heat in moderation, it keeps human bodies in their proper condition, and where its path is very close at hand, it parches them up and burns out and takes away the proportion of moisture which they ought to possess. But on the other hand, in the cold regions that are far away from the south, the moisture is not drawn out by hot weather, but the atmosphere is full of dampness which diffuses moisture into the system and makes the frame larger and the pitch of the voice deeper. This is also the reason why the races that are bred in the north are of vast height and have fair complexions, straight red hair, grey eyes, and a great deal of blood, owing to the abundance of moisture and the coolness of the atmosphere. 4. On the contrary, those that are nearest to the southern half of the axis and that lie directly under the sun's course are of a lower stature, with a swarthy complexion, hair curling, black eyes, strong legs, and but a little blood on account of the force of the sun. Hence, too, this poverty of blood makes them over timid to stand up against the sword, but great heat and fevers they can endure without timidity because their frames are bred up in the raging heat. Hence, men that are born in the north are rendered over timid and weak by fever, but their wealth of blood enables them to stand up against the sword without timidity. 5. The pitch of the voice is likewise different and varying in quality with different nations for the following reasons. The terminating points east and west on the level of the earth, where the upper and lower parts of the heaven are divided, seem to lie in a naturally balanced circle which mathematicians call the horizon. Keeping this idea definitely in mind, if we imagine a line drawn from the northern side of the circumference to the side which lies above the southern half of the axis, and from here another line obliquely up to the pivot of the summit, beyond the stars composing the Great Bear, we shall doubtless see that we have in the heaven a triangular figure like that of the musical instrument which the Greeks call the sambuca. 6. And so, under the space which is nearest to the pivot at the bottom, off the southern portions of the line of the axis, are found nations that, on account of the slight altitude of the heaven above them, have shrill and very high-pitched voices, like the string nearest to the angle in the musical instrument. Next, in order, come other nations as far as the middle of Greece, which lower elevations of the voice, and from this middle point they go in regular order up to the extreme north, where under high altitudes the vocal utterance of the inhabitants is, under natural laws, produced in heavier tones. Thus it is obvious that the system of the universe as a whole is, on account of the inclination of the heaven, composed in a most perfect harmony through the temporary power of the sun. 7. The nations, therefore, that lie midway between the pivots at the southern and the northern extremities of the axis, converse in a voice of middle pitch, like the notes in the middle of a musical scale, but, as we proceed towards the north, the distances to the heaven become greater, and so the nations there, whose vocal utterance is reduced by the moisture to the hypetes and to proslambanomenon, are naturally obliged to speak in heavier tones. In the same way, as we proceed from the middle point to the south, the voices of the nations there correspond in extreme height of pitch and in shrillness to the parnates and nates. 8. That it is a fact that things are made heavier from being in places naturally moist, and higher, pitched from places that are hot, may be proved from the following experiment. Take two cups which have been baked in the same oven for an equal time, which are of equal weight, and which give the same note when struck. Dip one of them in water, and after taking it out of water, strike them both. This done, there will be a great difference in their notes, and the cups can no longer be equal in weight. Thus it is with men. Though born in the same general form and under the same all-embracing heaven, yet in some of them, on account of the heat in their country, the voice strikes the air on a high note, while in others, on account of abundance of moisture, the quality of the tones produced is very heavy. 9. Further, it is owing to the rarity of the atmosphere that southern nations, with their keen intelligence due to the heat, are very free and swift in the devising of schemes, while northern nations, being enveloped in a dense atmosphere and chilled by moisture from the obstructing air, have but a sluggish intelligence. That this is so, we may see from the case of snakes. Their movements are most active in hot weather, when they have got rid of the chill due to moisture, whereas the winter solstice and in winter weather they are chilled by the change of temperature and rendered torpid and motionless. It is therefore no wonder that man's intelligence is made keener by warm air and duller by cold. 10. But although southern nations have keenest wits and are infinitely clever in forming schemes, yet the moment it comes to displaying valor, they succumb, because all manliness of spirit is sucked out of them by the sun. On the other hand, men born in cold countries are indeed readier to meet the shock of arms with great courage and without timidity, but their wits are so slow that they will rush to the charge inconsiderately and inexpertly, thus defeating their own devices. Such being nature's arrangement of the universe, and all these nations being allotted temperaments which are lacking in due moderation, the truly perfect territory, situated under the middle of the heaven, and having on each side the entire extent of the world and its countries, is that which is occupied by the Roman people. 11. In fact, the races of Italy are the most perfectly constituted in both respects, in bodily form and in mental activity, to correspond to their valor. Exactly as the planet Jupiter is itself temperate, its course lying midway between Mars, which is very hot, and Saturn, which is very cold, so Italy, lying between the north and the south, is a combination of what is found on each side, and her preeminence is well regulated and indisputable. And so by her wisdom she breaks the courageous onsets of the barbarians, and by her strength of hand thwarts the devices of the southerners. Hence it was the divine intelligence that set the city of the Roman people in a peerless and temperate country, in order that it might acquire the right to command the whole world. 12. Now if it is the fact that countries differ from one another, and are of various classes according to climate, so that the very nations born therein naturally differ in mental and physical conformation and qualities, we cannot hesitate to make our houses suitable in plan to the peculiarities of nations and races, since we have the expert guidance of nature herself ready to our hand. I have now set forth the peculiar characteristics of localities, so far as I could note them, in the most summary way, and I have stated how we ought to make our houses conform to the physical qualities of nations, with due regard to the course of the sun and to climate. Next I shall treat the symmetrical proportions of the different styles of houses, both as wholes and in their separate parts. End of Book 6, Chapter 1. Book 6, Chapters 2 to 5 of 10 Books on Architecture. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Fredrik Karlsson. 10 Books on Architecture by Vitruvius. Translated by Morris Hickey Morgan. Chapter 2. Symmetry and modification in it to suit the site. 1. There is nothing to which an architect should devote more thought than to the exact proportions of his buildings with reference to a certain part selected as the standard. After the standard of symmetry has been determined, and the proportionate dimensions adjusted by calculations, it is next the part of wisdom to consider the nature of the site, or questions of use or beauty, and modify the plan by diminutions or additions in such a manner that these diminutions or additions in the symmetrical relations may be seen to be made on correct principles, and without detracting at all from the effect. 2. The look of a building when seen close at hand is one thing, on height it is another. Not the same in an enclosed place, still different in the open, and in all these cases it takes much judgment to decide what is to be done. The fact is that the eye does not always give a true impression, but very often leads the mind to form a false judgment. In painted scenery, for example, columns may appear to jut out, mutules to project, and statues to be standing in the foreground, although the picture is of course perfectly flat. Similarly with ships, the oars when under the water are straight, though to the eye they appear to be broken. To the point where they touch the surface of the sea they look straight, as indeed they are, but when dipped under the water they emit from their bodies undulating images which come swimming up through the naturally transparent medium to the surface of the water, and, being here thrown into commotion, make the oars look broken. 3. Now, whether this appearance is due to the impact of the images, or to the effusion of the rays from the eye, as the physicist told, in either case it is obvious that the vision may lead us to false impressions. 4. Since, therefore, the reality may have a false appearance, and since things are sometimes represented by the eyes as other than they are, I think it certain that diminutions or additions should be made to suit the nature or needs of the site, but in such fashion that the buildings lose nothing thereby. These results, however, are also attainable by flashes of genius, and not only by mere science. 5. Hence, the first thing to settle is the standard of symmetry, from which we need not hesitate to vary. Then, lay out the ground lines of the length and breadth of the work proposed, and when once we have determined its size, let the construction follow this with due regard to beauty of proportion, so that the beholder may feel no doubt of the eurythmy of its effect. I must now tell how this may be brought about, and first I will speak of the proper construction of a cavaedium. Chapter 3. Proportions of the principal rooms. 1. There are 5 different styles of cavaedium, termed according to their construction as follows: Tuscan, Corinthian, tetrastyle, displuviate, and testudinate. In the Tuscan, the girders that cross the breadth of the atrium have crossbeams on them, and valleys sloping in and running from the angles of the walls to the angles formed by the beams, and the rainwater falls down along the rafters to the roof opening, compluvium, in the middle. In the Corinthian, the girders and roof opening are constructed on these same principles, but the girders run in from the side walls and are supported all round on columns. In the tetrastyle, the girders are supported at the angles by columns, an arrangement which relieves and strengthens the girders, for thus they have themselves no great span to support, and they are not loaded down by the crossbeams. 2. In the displuviate, there are beams which slope outwards, supporting the roof and throwing the rainwater off. This style is suitable chiefly in winter residences, for its roof opening, being high up, is not an obstruction to the light of the dining rooms. It is, however, very troublesome to keep in repair, because the pipes which are intended to hold the water that comes dripping down the walls all around cannot take it quickly enough as it runs down from the channels, but get too full and run over, thus spoiling the woodwork and the walls of houses of this style. The testudinate is employed where the span is not great and where large rooms are provided in upper stories. 3. In width and length, atriums are designed according to three classes. The first is laid out by dividing the length into five parts and giving three parts to the width, the second by dividing it into three parts and assigning two parts to the width, the third by using the width to describe a square figure with equal sides, drawing a diagonal line in this square and giving the atrium the length of this diagonal line. 4. Their height up to the girders should be 1/4 less than their width, the rest being the proportion assigned to the ceiling and the roof above the girders. The alae to the right and left should have a width equal to 1/3 of the length of the atrium, when that is from 30 to 40 feet long, from 40 to 50 feet, divide the length by 3 1/2 and give the alae the result. When it is from 50 to 60 feet in length, devote 1/4 of the length to the alae. From 60 to 80 feet, divide the length by 4 1/2 and let the result be the width of the alae. From 80 feet to 100 feet, the length divided into five parts will produce the right width for the alae. Their lintel beams should be placed high enough to make the height of the alae equal to their width. 5. The tablinum should be given 2/3 of the width of the atrium when the latter is 20 feet wide. If it is from 30 to 40 feet, let half the width of the atrium be devoted to the tablinum. When it is from 40 to 60 feet, divide the width into five parts and let two of these be set apart for the tablinum. In the case of smaller atriums, the symmetrical proportions cannot be the same as in larger, for if, in the case of the smaller, we employ the proportion that belong to the larger, both tablina and alae must be unserviceable, while if, in the case of the larger, we employ the proportions of the smaller, the rooms mentioned will be huge monstrosities. Hence, I have thought it best to describe exactly their respective proportionate sizes, with a view both to convenience and to beauty. 6. The height of the tablinum at the lintel should be 1/8 more than its width. Its ceiling should exceed this height by 1/3 of the width. The fauces in the case of smaller atriums should be 2/3, and in the case of larger one, 1/2 the width of the tablinum. Let the busts of the ancestors with their ornaments be set up at a height corresponding to the width of the alae. The proportionate width and height of doors may be settled, if they are Doric, in the Doric manner, and if Ionic, in the Ionic manner, according to the rules of symmetry which have been given about portals in the fourth book. In the roof opening, let an aperture be left with a breadth of not less than 1/4 nor more than 1/3 the width of the atrium, and with a length proportionate to that of the atrium. 7. Peristyle lying athwart should be 1/3 longer than they are deep, and their columns as high as the colonnades are wide. Intercolumniations of peristyles should be not less than 3 nor more than 4 times the thickness of the columns. If the columns of the peristyle are to be made in the Doric style, take the modules which I have given in the fourth book on the Doric order and arrange the columns with reference to these modules and to the scheme of the triglyphs. 8. Dining rooms ought to be twice as long as they are wide. The height of all oblong rooms should be calculated by adding together their measured length and width, taking 1/2 of this total and using the result for the height. But in the case of exedrae or square erci, let the height be brought up to 1 1/2 times the width. Picture galleries, like exedrae, should be constructed of generous dimensions. Corinthian and tetrastyle erci, as well as those termed Egyptian, should have the same symmetrical proportions in width and length as the dining rooms described above, but since they have columns in them, their dimensions should be ampler. 9. The following will be the distinction between Corinthian and Egyptian oeci. The Corinthian have single tiers of columns set either on a podium or on the ground, with architraves over them and coronae either of a woodwork or of stucco, and carved vaulted ceilings above the coronae. In the Egyptian there are architraves over the columns and joists laid thereon from the architraves to the surrounding walls, with a floor in the upper story to allow of walking round under the open sky. Then, upon the architrave and perpendicularly over the lower tier of columns, columns 1/4 smaller should be imposed. Above their architraves and ornaments are decorated ceilings, and the upper columns have windows set in between them. Thus the Egyptian are not like Corinthian dining rooms, but obviously resemble basilicas. 10. There are also, though not customary in Italy, the echi, which the Greeks call Cisizine. These are built with a northern exposure and generally command a view of gardens, and have folding doors in the middle. They are also so long and so wide that two sets of dining couches facing each other, with room to pass round them, can be placed therein. On the right and left they have windows which open like folding doors, so that views of the garden may be had from the dining couches through the open windows. The height of such rooms is 1 1/2 times their width. 11. All the above-mentioned symmetrical relations should be observed in these kinds of buildings, that can be observed without embarrassment caused by the situation. The windows will be an easy matter to arrange if they are not darkened by high walls, but in cases of confined space, when there are other unavoidable obstructions, it will be permissible to make diminutions or additions in the symmetrical relations, with ingenuity and acuteness, however, so that the result may be not unlike the beauty which is due to true symmetry. Chapter 4. The proper exposures of the different rooms. 1. We shall next explain how the special purposes of different rooms require different exposures, suited to convenience and to the quarters of the sky. Winter dining rooms and bathrooms should have a southwestern exposure for the reason that they need the evening light, and also because the setting sun, facing them in all its splendor but with abated heat, lends a gentler warmth through that quarter in the evening. Bedrooms and libraries ought to have an eastern exposure, because their purposes require the morning light, and also because books in such libraries will not decay. In libraries with southern exposures, the books are ruined by worms and dampness, because damp winds come up, which breed and nourish the worms, and destroy the books with mold, by spreading their damped breath over them. 2. Dining rooms for spring and autumn to the east. For when the windows face that quarter, the sun, as he goes on his career from over against them to the west, leaves such rooms at the proper temperature at the time when it is customary to use them. Summer dining rooms to the north, because that quarter is not, like the others, burning with heat during the solstice, for the reason that it is unexposed to the sun's course, and hence it always keeps cool, and makes the use of the rooms both healthy and agreeable. Similarly with picture galleries, embroiderers' workrooms, and painters' studios, in order that the fixed light may permit the colors used in their work to last with qualities unchanged. Chapter 5. How the rooms should be suited to the station of the owner. 1. After settling the positions of the rooms with regard to the quarters of the sky, we must next consider the principles on which should be constructed those apartments in private houses which are meant for the householders themselves, and those which are shared in common with outsiders. The private rooms are those into which nobody has the right to enter without an invitation, such as bedrooms, dining rooms, bathrooms, and all others used for the like purposes. The common are those which any of the people have a perfect right to enter, even without an invitation, that is, entrance courts, cavadia, peristyles, and all intended for the like purpose. Hence, men of everyday fortune do not need entrance courts, tablinae, or atriums built in grand style, because such men are more apt to discharge their social obligations by going round to others than to have others come to them. 2. Those who do business in country produce must have stalls and shops in their entrance courts, with crypts, granaries, storerooms, and so forth in their houses, constructed more for the purpose of keeping the produce in good condition than for an ornamental beauty. For capitalists and farmers of the revenue, somewhat comfortable and showy apartments must be constructed, secure against robbery. For advocates and public speakers, handsomer and more roomy to accommodate meetings. For men of rank who, from holding offices and magistracies, have social obligations to their fellow citizens, lofty entrance courts in regal style, and most spacious atriums and peristyles with plantations and walks of some extent in them, appropriate to their dignity. They need also libraries, picture galleries, and basilicas, finished in a style similar to that of great public buildings, since public councils as well as private lawsuits and hearings before arbitrators are very often held in the houses of such men. 3. If, therefore, houses are planned on these principles to suit different classes of persons, as described in my first book, under the subject of propriety, there will be no room for criticism, for they will be arranged with convenience and perfection to suit every purpose. The rules on these points will hold not only for houses in town, but also for those in the country, except that in town atriums are usually next to the front door, while in country seats peristyles come first, and then atriums surrounded by paved colonnades opening upon palaestrae and walks. I have now set forth the rules for houses in town so far as I could describe them in a summary way. Next I shall state how farmhouses may be arranged with a view to convenience in use, and shall give the rules for their construction. End of Book 6, Chapter 5. Book 6, Chapters 6 to 8 of 10 Books on Architecture. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Fredrik Karlsson. 10 Books on Architecture by Vitruvius. Translated by Morris Hickey Morgan. Chapter 6. The Farmhouse. 1. In the first place, inspect the country from the point of view of health, in accordance with what is written in my first book, on the building of cities, and let your farmhouses be situated accordingly. Their dimensions should depend upon the size of the farm and the amount of produce. Their courtyards and the dimensions thereof should be determined by the number of cattle and the number of yokes of oxen that will need to be kept therein. Let the kitchen be placed on the warmest side of the courtyard, with the stalls for the oxen adjoining, and their cribs facing the kitchen fire in the eastern quarter of the sky, for the reason that oxen facing the light and the fire do not get rough-coated. Even peasants, wholly without knowledge of the quarters of the sky, believe that oxen ought to face only in the direction of the sunrise. 2. Their stalls ought to be not less than 10 nor more than 15 feet wide, and long enough to allow not less than 7 feet for each yoke. Bathrooms, also, should adjoin the kitchen, for in this situation it will not take long to get ready a bath in the country. Let the pressing room, also, be next to the kitchen, for in this situation it will be easy to deal with the fruit of the olive. Adjoining it should be the wine room, with its windows lighted from the north. In a room with windows on any other quarter, so that the sun can heat it, the heat will get into the wine and make it weak. 3. The oil room must be situated so as to get its light from the south and from warm quarters, for oil ought not to be chilled, but should be kept thin by gentle heat. In dimensions, oil rooms should be built to accommodate the crop and the proper number of jars, each of which, holding about 120 gallons, must take up a space 4 feet in diameter. The pressing room itself, if the pressure is exerted by means of levers and a beam, and not worked by turning screws, should be not less than 40 feet long, which will give the leverman a convenient amount of space. It should be not less than 16 feet wide, which will give the men who are at work plenty of free space to do the turning conveniently. If 2 presses are required in the place, allow 24 feet for the width. 4. Folds for sheep and goats must be made large enough to allow each animal a space of not less than 4.5 nor more than 6 feet. Rooms for grain should be set in an elevated position and with a northern or northeastern exposure. Thus the grain will not be able to heat quickly, but, being cooled by the wind, keeps a long time. Other exposures produce the corn weevil and the other little creatures that are wont to spoil the grain. To the stable should be assigned the very warmest place in the farmhouse, provided that it is not exposed to the kitchen fire, for when draught animals are stabled very near a fire, their coats get rough. 5. Furthermore, there are advantages in building cribs, apart from the kitchen and in the open, facing the east, for when the oxen are taking over to them on early winter mornings in clear weather, their coats get sleeker as they take their fodder in the sunlight. Barns for grain, hay, and spelt, as well as bakeries, should be built apart from the farmhouse, so that farmhouses may be better protected against danger from fire. If something more refined is required in farmhouses, they may be constructed on the principles of symmetry which have been given above in the case of townhouses, provided that there is nothing in such buildings to interfere with their usefulness on a farm. 6. We must take care that all buildings are well lighted, but this is obviously an easier matter with those which are on country estates, because there can be no neighbor's wall to interfere, whereas in town high party walls or limited space obstruct the light and make them dark. Hence we must apply the following test in this matter. On the side from which the light should be obtained, let a line be stretched from the top of the wall that seems to obstruct the light to the point at which it ought to be introduced, and if a considerable space of open sky can be seen when one looks up above that line, there will be no obstruction to the light in that situation. 7. But if there are timbers in the way, or lintels, or upper stores, then make the opening higher up and introduce the light in this way. And as a general rule, we must arrange so as to leave places for windows on all sides on which a clear view of the sky can be had, for this will make our buildings light. Not only in dining rooms and other rooms for general use are windows very necessary, but also in passages, level or inclined, and on stairs, for people carrying burdens too often meet and run against each other in such places. I have now set forth the plans used for buildings in our native country so that they may be clear to builders. Next I shall describe summarily how houses are planned in the Greek fashion, so that those also may be understood. Chapter 7. The Greek House. 1. The Greeks, having no use for atriums, do not build them, but make passageways for people entering from the front door, not very wide, with stables on one side and doorkeepers' rooms on the other, and shut off by doors at the inner end. This place between the two doors is termed in Greek thyrorion. From it one enters the peristyle. This peristyle has colonnades on three sides, and on the side facing the south it has two antae, a considerable distance apart, carrying an architrave with a recess for the distance one-third less than the space between the antae. This space is called by some writers prostas, by others pastas. 2. Hereabouts, towards the inner side, are the large rooms in which mistresses of the house sit with their wool spinners. To the right and left of the prostas there are chambers, one of which is called the thalamos, the other the amphithalamus. All round the colonnades are dining rooms for everyday use, chambers and rooms for the slaves. This part of the house is called gynaeconitis. 3. In connection with these there are ampler sets of apartments with more sumptuous peristyles, surrounded by four colonnades of equal height, or else the one which faces the south has higher columns than the others. A peristyle that has one such higher colonnade is called a Rhodian peristyle. Such apartments have fine entrance courts with imposing front doors of their own. The colonnades of the peristyles are decorated with polished stucco in relief and plain, and with coffered ceilings of woodwork. Off the colonnades that face the north they have Sisaean dining rooms and picture galleries, to the east libraries, exedrae to the west, and to the south large square rooms of such generous dimensions that four sets of dining couches can easily be arranged in them, with plenty of room for serving and for the amusements. 4. Men's dinner parties are held in these large rooms, for it was not the practice according to Greek custom for the mistress of the house to be present. On the contrary, such peristyles are called the men's apartments, since in them the men can stay without interruption from the women. Furthermore, small sets of apartments are built to the right and left, with front doors of their own and suitable dining rooms and chambers, so that guests from abroad need not to be shown into the peristyles, but rather into such guests' apartments. For when the Greeks became more luxurious and their circumstances more opulent, they began to provide dining rooms, chambers, and storerooms of provisions for their guests from abroad, and on the first day they would invite them to dinner, sending them on the next chickens, eggs, vegetables, fruits, and other country produce. This is why artists called pictures representing the things which were sent to guests senia. Thus, too, the heads of families, while being entertained abroad, had the feeling that they were not away from home, since they enjoyed privacy and freedom in such guests' apartments. 5. Between the two peristyles and the guests' apartments are the passageways, called mesolae, because they are situated midway between two courts, but our people call them andrones. This, however, is a very strange fact, for the term does not fit either the Greek or the Latin use of it. The Greek call the large rooms in which men's dinner parties are usually held andrones, because women do not go there. There are other similar instances, as in the case of xystus, prothyrum, telamones, and some others of the sort. As a Greek term, xystus, means a colonnade of large dimensions in which athletes exercise in the winter time, but our people apply the term xysta to uncovered walks, which the Greeks called paradromides. Again, Prothyra means in Greek the entrance courts before the front doors. We, however, use the term prothyra in the sense of the Greek diathera. 6. Again, figures in the form of men supporting mutules or coronae we term telamones. The reason why or wherefore they are so called are not found in any story, but the Greeks name them Atlantes. For Atlas is described in story as holding up the firmament because through his vigorous intelligence and ingenuity he was the first cause men to be taught about the causes of the sun and moon and the laws governing the revolutions of all the constellations. Consequently, in recognition of this benefaction, painters and sculptors represent him as holding up the firmament, and the Atlantes, his daughters, whom we call Vergiliae and the Greeks Pleiades, are consecrated in the firmament among the constellations. 7. All this, however, I have not set forth for the purpose of changing the usual terminology or language, but I have thought it should be explained so that it may be known to scholars. I have now explained the usual ways of planning houses both in the Italian fashion and according to the practices of the Greeks, and have described with regard to their symmetry the proportions of the different classes. Having therefore already written of their beauty and propriety, I shall next explain, with reference to durability, how they may be built to last to a great age without defects. Chapter 8. On Foundations and Substructures. 1. Houses which are set level with the ground will no doubt last to a great age, if their foundations are laid in the manner which we have explained in the earlier books, with regard to city walls and theatres. But if underground rooms and vaults are intended, their foundations ought to be thicker than the walls which are to be constructed in the upper parts of the house, and the walls, piers, and columns of the latter should be set perpendicularly over the middle of the foundation walls below, so that they may have solid bearing. For if the load of the walls or columns rests on the middle of spans, they can have no permanent durability. 2. It will also do no harm to insert posts between lintels and sills, where there are piers or anti, for where the lintels and beams have received the load of the walls, they may sag in the middle and gradually undermine and destroy the walls. But when there are posts set up underneath and wedged in there, they prevent the beams from settling and injuring such walls. 3. We must also manage to discharge the load of the walls by means of archings composed of voussoirs with joints radiating to the center. For when arches with voussoirs are sprung from the ends of beams or from the bearings of lintels, in the first place they will discharge the load and the wood will not sag. Secondly, if in course of time the wood becomes at all defective, it can easily be replaced without the construction of shoring. 4. Likewise in houses where piers are used in the construction, when there are arches composed of voussoirs with joints radiating to the center, the outermost piers at these points must be made broader than the others so that they may have the strength to resist when the wedges, under the pressure of the load of the walls, begin to press along their joints towards the center and thus to thrust out the abutments. Hence, if the piers at the ends are of larger dimensions, they will hold the voussoirs together and make such works durable. 5. Having taken heed in these matters to see the proper attention is paid to them, we must also be equally careful that all walls are perfectly vertical and that they do not lean forward anywhere. Particular pains, too, must be taken with substructures, for here an endless amount of harm is usually done by the earth used as filling. This cannot always remain of the same weight that it usually has in summer, but in winter time it increases in weight and bulk by taking up a great deal of rainwater, and then it bursts its enclosing walls and thrusts them out. 6. The following means must be taken to provide against such a defect. First, let the walls be given a thickness proportionate to the amount of filling. Secondly, build counterforts or buttresses at the same time as the wall, on the outer side, at distances from each other equivalent to what is to be the height of the substructure and with the thickness of the substructure. At the bottom, let them run out to a distance corresponding to the thickness that has been determined for the substructure, and then gradually diminish in extent so that at the surface their projection is equal to the thickness of the wall of the building. 7. Furthermore, inside, to meet the mass of earth, there should be saw-shaped constructions attached to the wall, the single teeth extending from the wall for a distance equivalent to what is to be the height of the substructure, and the teeth being constructed with the same thickness as the wall. then at the outermost angles take a distance inwards from the inside of the angle equal to the height of the substructure and mark it off on each side. From these marks build up a diagonal structure, and from the middle of it a second joined on to the angle of the wall. With this arrangement, the teeth and diagonal structures will not allow the filling to thrust with all its force against the wall, but will check and distribute the pressure. 8. I have now shown how buildings can be constructed without defects and the way to take precautions against the occurrence of them. As for replacing tiles, roof timbers and rafters, we need not to be so particular about them as about the parts just mentioned, because they can easily be replaced, however defective they may become. Hence, I have shown by what methods the parts which are not considered solid can be rendered durable, and how they are constructed. 9. As for the kind of material to be used, this does not depend upon the architect, for the reason that all kinds of materials are not found in all places alike, as has been shown in the first book. Besides, it depends on the owner whether he desires to build in brick, or rubble work, or dimension stone. Consequently, the question of approving any work may be considered under three heads, that is, delicacy of workmanship, sumptuousness, and design. When it appears that a work has been carried out sumptuously, the owner will be the person to be praised for the great outlay which he has authorized. When delicately, the master workman will be approved for his execution, but when proportions and symmetry lend it an imposing effect, then the glory of it will belong to the architect. 10. Such results, however, may very well be brought about when he allows himself to take the advice both of workmen and of laymen. In fact, all kinds of men, and not merely architects, can recognize a good piece of work. But between laymen and the latter there is this difference, that the layman cannot tell what it is to be like without seeing it finished, whereas the architect, as soon as he has formed the conception and before he begins the work, has a definite idea of the beauty, the convenience, and the propriety that will distinguish it. I have now described as clearly as I could what I thought necessary for private houses, and how to build them. In the following book I shall treat of the kinds of polished finish employed to make them elegant and durable without defects to a great age. End of book 6. Book 7 of 10 books on architecture. Introduction. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Fredrik Karlsson. 10 Books on Architecture by Vitruvius, translated by Morris Hickey Morgan. Book 7. Introduction. 1. It was a wise and useful provision of the ancients to transmit their thoughts to posterity by recording them in treatises, so that they should not be lost, but, being developed in succeeding generations through publication in books, should gradually attain in later times to the highest refinement of learning. And so the ancients deserve no ordinary but unending thanks, because they did not pass on in envious silence, but took care that their ideas of every kind should be transmitted to the future in the writings. 2. If they had not done so, we could not have known what deeds were done in Troy, nor what Thales, Democritus, Anaxagoras, Xenophanes, and the other physicists thought about nature, and what rules Socrates, Plato, Aristotle, Zeno, Epicurus, and other philosophers laid down for the conduct of human life, nor would the deeds and motives of Croesus, Alexander, Darius, and other kings have been known unless the ancients had compiled treatises and published them in commentaries to be had in universal remembrance with posterity. 3. So, while they deserve our thanks, those, on the contrary, deserve our reproaches who steal the writings of such men and publish them as their own, and those also who depend in their writings not on their own ideas, but who enviously do wrong to the works of others and boast of it, deserve not merely to be blamed, but to be sentenced to actual punishment for their wicked course of life. With the ancients, however, it is said that such things did not pass without pretty strict chastisement. What the results of their judgments were, it may not be out of place to set forth as they transmitted to us. 4. The kings of the house of Attalus, having established, under the influence of the great charms of literature, an excellent library at Pergamus to give pleasure to the public, Ptolemy also was aroused with no end of enthusiasm and emulation into exertions to make a similar provisions with no less diligence at Alexandria. Having done so with the greatest care, he felt that this was not enough without providing for its increase and development, for which he sowed the seed. He established public contests in honor of the Muses and Apollo, and appointed prizes and honors for victorious authors in general, as is done in the case of athletes. 5. These arrangements having been made, and the contests being at hand, it became necessary to select literary men as judges to decide them. The king soon selected 6 of the citizens, but could not easily find a proper person to be the 7th. He therefore turned to those who presided over the library and asked whether they knew anybody who was suitable for the purpose. Then they told him that there was one Aristophanes, who was daily engaged in reading through all the books with the greatest enthusiasm and the greatest care. Hence, when the gathering for the contest took place, and separate seats were set apart for the judges, Aristophanes was summoned with the rest and sat down in the place assigned to him. 6. A group of poets were first brought in to contend, and as they recited their compositions, the whole audience, by its applause, showed the judges what it approved. So, when they were individually asked for their votes, the 6 agreed and awarded the first prize to the poet who, as they observed, had most pleased the multitude, and the 2nd to the one who came next. But Aristophanes, on being asked for his vote, urged that the poet who had least pleased the audience should be declared to be the first. 7. As the king and the entire assembly showed great indignation, he arose and asked and received permission to speak. Silence being obtained, he stated that only one of them, his man, was a poet, and that the rest had recited things not their own. Furthermore, that judges ought to give their approval not to thefts, but to original compositions. The people were amazed, and the king hesitated, but Aristophanes, trusting to his memory, had a vast number of volumes brought out from bookcases which he specified, and, by comparing them with what had been recited, obliged the thieves themselves to make confession. So the king gave orders that they should be accused of theft, and after condemnation sent them off in disgrace. But he honored Aristophanes with the most generous gifts and put him in charge of the library. 8. Some years later, Zoilus, who took the surname of Homeromastix, came from Macedonia to Alexandria, and read to the king his writings directed against the Iliad and Odyssey. Ptolemy, seeing the father of poets and captain of all literature abused in his absence and his works, to which all the world looked up in admiration, disparaged by this person, made no rejoinder, although he thought it an outrage. Zoilus, however, after remaining in the kingdom some time, sank into poverty and sent a message to the king requesting that something might be bestowed upon him. 9. But it is said that the king replied that Homer, though dead 1,000 years ago, had all that time been the means of livelihood for many thousands of men. Similarly, a person who laid claim to higher genius ought to be able to support not one man only, but many others. And in short, various stories are told about his death, which was like that of one found guilty of parricide. Some writers have said that he was crucified by Philadelphus, others that he was stoned at Chios, others again that he was thrown alive upon a funeral pyre at Smyrna. Whichever of these forms of death befell him, it was a fitting punishment in his just due. For one who accuses men that cannot answer and show, face to face, what was the meaning of the writings, obviously deserves no other treatment. 10. But for my part, Caesar, I am not bringing forward the present treatise after changing the titles of other men's book and inserting my own name, nor has it been my plan to win approbation by finding fault with ideas of another. On the contrary, I express unlimited thanks to all the authors that have in the past, by compiling from antiquity remarkable instances of the skill shown by genius, provided us with abundant materials of different kinds. Drawing from them, as it were, water from springs and converting them to our own purposes, we find our powers of writing rendered more fluent and easy, and, relying upon such authorities, we venture to produce new systems of instruction. 11. Hence, as I saw that such beginnings on their part formed an introduction suited to the nature of my own purpose, I set out to draw from them and to go somewhat further. In the first place, Agatharchus in Athens, when Aeschylus was bringing out a tragedy, painted a scene and left a commentary about it. This has led Democritus and Anaxagoras to write on the same subject, showing how, given a center in a definite place, the lines should naturally correspond with due regard to the point of sight and the divergence of the visual rays, so that by this deception a faithful representation of the appearance of buildings might be given in painted scenery, and so that, though all is drawn on a vertical flat facade, some parts may seem to be withdrawing into the background and others to be standing out in front. 12. Afterwards, Silenus published a book on the proportions of Doric structures. Theodorus on the Doric temple of Juno, which is in Samos, Cursiphron and Metagenes on the Ionic temple at Ephesus, which is Diana's, Pythios on the Ionic fane of Minerva, which is at Priene, Ictinus and Carpion on the Doric temple of Minerva, which is on the Acropolis of Athens. Theodorus the Phocian on the round building which is at Delphi, Philo on the proportions of temples and on the naval arsenal which was at the port of Piraeus, Hermogenes on the Ionic temple of Diana which is at Magnesia, Pseudodipteral, and on that of Father Bacchus at Theos, Monopteral, Arcesius on the Corinthian proportions and on the Ionic temple of Aesculapius Attralus, which it is said that he built with his own hands. On the mausoleum, Satyrus and Pythios, who were favoured with the greatest and highest good fortune. 13. For men whose artistic talents are believed to have won them the highest renown for all time and laurels forever green, devised and executed works of supreme excellence in this building. The decoration and perfection of the different facades were undertaken by different artists in emulation with each other. Leochares, Bryoxis, Scopas, Praxiteles, and, as some think, Timotheus, and the distinguished excellence of their art made that building famous among the seven wonders of the world. 14. Then, too, many less celebrated men have written treatises on the laws of symmetry, such as Nexaris, Theocydes, Demophilus, Polis, Leonidas, Silanion, Melampus, Sarnicus, and Evphranor. Others again on machinery, such as Diades, Archytas, Archimedes, Ctesibius, Nymphodorus, Philo of Byzantium, Diphilus, Democles, Carius, Polyidus, Pyrrhus, and Agesistratus. From their commentaries I have gathered what I saw was useful for the present subject and formed it into one complete treatise, and this principally because I saw that many books in this field had been published by the Greeks, but very few indeed by our countrymen. Fufisius, in fact, was the first to undertake to publish a book on this subject. Terentius Varro, also in his work on the Nine Sciences, has one book on architecture, and Publius Septimius, two. 15. But to this day nobody else seems to have bent his energies to his branch of literature, although there have been, even among our fellow citizens in old times, great architects who could also have written with elegance. For instance, in Athens the architects Antistates, Calaiscris, Antimachides, and Pormus laid the foundations when Peisistratus began the temple of Olympian Jove, but after his death they abandoned the undertaking on account of political troubles. Hence, it was that when, about 400 years later, King Antiochus promised to pay the expenses of that work, the huge cella, the surrounding columns in dipteral arrangement, and their architraves and other ornaments, adjusted according to the laws of symmetry, were nobly constructed with great skill and supreme knowledge by Colsutius, a citizen of Rome. Moreover, this work has a name for its grandeur, not only in general, but also among the select few. 16. There are, in fact, four places possessing temples embellished with workmanship in marble that causes them to be mentioned in a class by themselves with the highest renown. To their excellence and the wisdom of their conception they owe their place of esteem in the ceremonial worship of the gods. First, there is the temple of Diana at Ephesus, in the Ionic style, undertaken by Cursiphron of Gnosus and his son Metagenes, and said to have been finished later by Demetrius, who was himself a slave of Diana, and by Paeonius the Milesian. At Miletus, the temple of Apollo, also Ionic in its proportions, was the undertaking of the same Paeonius and the Ephesian Daphnis. At Eleusis, the cella of Ceres and Proserpine of vast size was completed to the roof by Ictinus in the Doric style, but without exterior columns and with plenty of rooms for the customary sacrifices. 17. Afterwards, however, when Demetrius of Phalerum was master of Athens, Philo set up columns in front before the temple and made it prostyle. Thus, by adding an entrance hall, he gave the initiates more room and imparted the greatest dignity to the building. Finally, in Athens, the temple of Olympian, with its dimensions on a generous scale and built in the Corinthian style and proportions, is said to have been constructed, as written above, by Cossutius, no commentary by whom has been found. But Cossutius is not the only man by whom we should like to have writings on our subject. Another is Gaius Mucius, who, having great knowledge on which to rely, completed the cella, columns, and entablature of the Marian Temple of Honor and Valor in symmetrical proportions according to the accepted rules of the art. If this building had been of marble, so that besides the refinement of its art it possessed dignity coming from magnificence and a great outlay, it would be reckoned among the first and greatest of works. 18. Since it appears, then, that our architects in the old days, and a good many even in our own times, have been as great as those of the Greeks, and nevertheless only a few of them have published treatises, I resolved not to be silent, but to treat the different topics methodically in different books. Hence, since I have given an account of private houses in the sixth book, in this, which is the seventh in order, I shall treat of polished finishings and the methods of giving them both beauty and durability. End of Book 7, Introduction.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Some things you wouldn't mind being stuck with, like a huge inheritance. But a phone that has to be plugged in just right so it charges is not one of those things. Switch to Verizon and we'll pay off your old phone up to $800 via prepaid MasterCard for a new one on us. Just trade in any phone from our top brands with select unlimited plans. $829.99 purchase with new smartphone line on select unlimited plans. Minimum $90 per month with auto pay plus taxes and fees for 36 months required. Plus $830 trade-in slash promo credit applied over 36 months. Trade-in terms apply. Payoff phone requires smartphone purchase and port-in with new smartphone line on select plan. Must provide most recent bill showing payoff amount of eligible phone. Additional terms apply.